Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Show yesterday, I had the woman from Code Pink on, and they do things, they disrupt congressional meetings, and they get arrested and things like that. Do those people actually affect change? Because my impression is the shareholders do a lot more than Code Pink.
I have a whole chapter on the anti...
Conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Oh, mercy sakes, thank goodness it is Monday! 2 days of intolerable enforced silence passed. And in fact, we enter the first full week of August loaded for bear. This is Head On. I'm Bob Kincaid, the only live programming on the network this day. Peter Godbold will be a rerun this evening at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. He's had a very, very busy weekend and is taking some time to sort of recoup and recharge. Hard-working man. I often call Ben Birch the hardest-working man in liberal talk, and I don't retreat from that one iota. But you know what? All the people who make the horn go are hard-working people. It takes a boatload of hard work to make everything that makes this this network run. It takes the dedicated efforts of John Fox, who keeps me off the ledge when audio things go sideways, not to mention his ongoing efforts to rebuild the website at headonradionetwork.com. It's coming along slowly but surely, and as quickly as John can make it happen. Then there's Peter Godbold, without whom this network would simply not be running, because we would have burned out our computers and gone off the air a long time ago without Peter's expertise. Then there is, of course, Ben Birch. Ben Birch, the hardest working man in liberal talk, who literally saved the format on the internet starting about, I think 2002. I mention a lot of this at the end of the show, but I thought it would be appropriate to mention it at the beginning as well, for a change. Then there's ELO, our moderator in the chat room, who has also become our videographer, who is cranking out some Jim Dandy videos. And in fact, there's a new one up. It goes back to the Savage Wiener's comments about autism being a racket. And if you'd like to see it, I believe it is up on the network page. If you go to headonradionetwork.com, I believe there's a new segment called Video. Click on that, and it should be the first thing that you see. And there's more stuff coming as we expand And basically what that is my remarks about the Savage Wiener from, I guess a couple of Fridays back. But you know what? It's still fresh. Because the Savage Wiener hasn't stopped hating people. The Savage Wiener hasn't stopped attacking people who are unable to defend themselves. So we've skewered him. We used that audio of mine from a couple of weeks back that was suggested and largely scripted by the Internet's most brilliant satirist, Eugene Finnerman, at FinnermanWorks.com. Your RDA of irony. We used that to give the Savage Wiener the flaying he so richly deserved. So go and have a look, because the ELO took it to an entirely new level. The first time I saw that, I think I cracked my spleen laughing. Lots of hard work goes into making the horn happen. The news ninjas, Susan and Gene, I don't know when they sleep. Stories simply do not get past them. Our blogger Betsy, Texas Betsy, is always coming up with new and intriguing pieces of information for us. And then there's you. Between you and our good friends, the hardest working, bravest people we know at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, you keep the network on the air. You keep the horn going. And it is my privilege, it is my honor, and it is my pride to be associated with you. And you are, of course, the most important part of this process. I was trying to explain to someone today the philosophical difference between commercial radio and what we do. You probably already know this, but I'm very, very serious when I say that commercial radio is driven by the ability of a given broadcaster to deliver you, the audience, into the hands of advertisers. I think that's really icky. So when we came up with the idea of the horn, we started trying to comprehend what it meant to create conversation radio. And one of the first things that came to mind was that conversation radio could not be impeded by cross purposes. As the book says, a man may not serve two masters. We would either serve you or serve Mammon and the advertisers. We made our choice. We decided to serve you. We decided that we wanted to deliver programming that you would find interesting, that you would find scintillating, that you would find welcoming, and that you would find exceptional. And we succeed. We have succeeded and continue to succeed beyond our wildest expectations. So that, if anyone deserves a pat on the back for that, you do. For making it possible for the horn to continue in its way. So, not a little golf clap. You man! You the woman! Big golf clap, okay? Thanks, everybody. Thanks. July was a tough month. We fell profoundly short, as we do, it seems, every month. And August is getting off to a rough start as well. But we will find a way to muddle through. That's all we can promise. We'll keep going as long as we can. Let's see. What's coming up tonight? In the 7 o'clock hour, the second hour of the program, which would be, of course, let's see, that's 7 o'clock here, so that's 4 o'clock on the West Coast, we'll be having a conversation with our longstanding buddy Brad Friedman to talk about the whole business of the anthrax case. I've deliberately left this story alone until I could try to digest as much of it as humanly possible. Because it was one of those things that makes, it just makes you go, no, not to, I'm sorry. With the suicide, or alleged suicide of Bruce Ivins, the first thing that popped into my mind was the evil colonel in Casablanca saying, We have not yet decided whether or not he committed suicide or was shot trying to escape. I get that feeling with this one, too. And the for-profit media isn't making me feel any better. Well, Brad Friedman over at bradblog.com has pulled together a good bit of information, and I pulled together a little something-something today myself that no one else seemed interested in asking. And I have, and we'll be talking about that at the top of the second hour of the program. I hope you'll be around for that. If you've got any questions for Brad, you can certainly call in and ask them. You know the phone number here. Toll free, 877-443-2366, 877-4-HEAD-ON. If you want to save us a nickel or a buck, 304-658-3333 on your own nickel. And we can go down that road. We can most assuredly go down that road. And, you know, it's you guys asking questions that leads to greater degrees of, greater degrees of perception all the way around. True, there are some things that cannot be accomplished by committee, and they don't build monuments to committee, but the fact of the matter is, two brains are always better than one brain, four brains are better than two, eight are better than four, 16 are better than eight, and so forth. And that's how we process, and that's how we come up with conclusions based on evidence and facts, not based on faith, not based on belief, but based on evidence and based on facts. Have a greater likelihood of being correct. So I hope you will apply some skull sweat to the Bruce Ivins issue when Brad and I begin to discuss it in the next hour. Where else? There's a dozen different places we can go. But it is Monday, and just like me, the rest of you had 2 days of enforced silence as well that I would just as soon bust out of if we possibly could. So light up the phones if you want to in this first hour. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, this is Juanita.
Hey, Juanita, how are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
No, I'm getting along.
I'll have a little two or three things I'd like to say.
Okay, go right ahead. Same all.
I'm sure you've heard of the ad about the Messiah.
Yeah.
And have you heard the thing that Hannity plays?
No. I don't. Luckily for me,
it's so non-biblical.
The life support system for a haircut is not on in any markets that can be reached with an antenna that I own. So I'm delightfully free of him.
I don't listen to him either, but they were talking about it on Air America. I was listening to Hartman. But anyway, you know what I don't understand, and you may know. Now, the thing is that the churches, like Hagee's, they want to bring on Armageddon. So Jesus will come back. Is that right? Isn't that what they say?
Yeah.
Well, isn't the Antichrist supposed to be here before then?
Depending on whose brand you drink, yeah.
Yeah. Why are they trying to stop the Antichrist? They think he is the Antichrist, which I don't think they think, but I'm sure they'll make some of their... A lot of their church members believe it. That doesn't make sense, does it?
No, it doesn't. No.
They're trying to duke us. What?
Well, the whole idea of sort of metaphysically hustling Jesus out the door to get in his golden rolls, holy rolls, and come blowing down out of the clouds is sort of antithetical to the, if you buy into this stuff again, is sort of antithetical to the whole process, because what did he himself say? No one knows the hour or the time?
Right.
Or the day or
that's
the time?
That's what I believe. That's what I believe. And do you understand what I'm trying to say?
Yes, I do. You are suggesting that at least in that eschatology, that point A has to come before point B,
I believe so.
And they're all wrapped up in trying to make point C happen before anybody even talks about A or B.
Right. I don't know. They were talking about how does Obama fight this. You know, it's kind of like you can't win for losing.
I'm a firm believer in laughter.
Yeah.
I mean, if he tries to something like that Messiah business, if he tries to address that directly, Juanita, he is in the soup before he can ever get started.
Yeah.
Because there's a certain degree of, it's like that old joke that, Stephen Wright, the great comedian Stephen Wright told, where the two guys are standing around talking and I think I've told this before. It's his joke, so I'll probably wreck it. But two guys are talking, and one says, you Christian? The other guy says, yeah. He goes, where do you go to church? He goes, I'm Baptist. First guy goes, yeah, me too. Southern Baptist or American Baptist? Guy goes, Southern Baptist. And he goes, yeah, me too. He says, with the Pentecostal twist or Southern Baptist, or no, I'm sorry, free will or soft shell? He goes, free will. He goes, me too. He goes, free will Southern Baptist predestination or free will Southern Baptist, free choice. And he goes, predestination. And the guy goes, well, I'm the other one. Die, heretic!
Yeah.
And so what I'm getting at here, Juanita, is that if you start trying to go toe to toe, then you're going to be involved in a discussion about how many angels can dance on the head of a pin.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And I don't care who you are, you lose that.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, you've got 1 minute on Meet the Punks or whatever to talk about it, while it's going to be brooded and ballyhooed from every pulpit in America. It's somewhat like the uphill with a foot in the bucket fight that liberal radio has, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. Well, they're calling him the Messiah, but why is that so bad? Since Bush said God chose him to be our president, so we would attack Iraq.
Shh, you're not supposed to say it. Remember that.
I'm being sarcastic.
I know. You are forgetting. You are forgetting.
Right.
You are forgetting.
I know.
George Bush never said God talked to him much. God told me to attack.
It's not my God. Don't talk to him.
Well, exactly. God told me to attack Saddam, and I did.
Yeah.
Anybody else walks around saying God's talking to them, they get the fun little sweater with the
right.
sleeves that tie in back.
But I was just thinking, why are they wanting one and not the other?
Because they're psycho freaks, Juanita? I mean, I'm just guessing.
I think that's an insult to psychos.
Well, I tend to agree, too, because psychos don't choose to be that way, but these people
yeah.
do.
Yeah, I've been one.
So like I said, you know, the answer to this is laughter. And that is to say, oh, they didn't mean that. That's big old joke. That's a silly bunch of kidders over there at the McCain. That's a real knee slapper.
What did Lieberman say to tell Obama to enjoy it or whatever?
But the interesting thing, though, is that in conjunction with this ad, if I understand correctly, Juanita, they've had the people over at old 894's website have had to go back and scrub a lot of old 894's comments where he's saying, my friends, I am the one. I am the one who, I am the one. They had to scrub all of that. Because you can't. Yeah, you can't have McCain running around saying, I am the one.
Oh, yeah.
You can't have him saying that when he's at the same time mocking.
He probably is.
Yeah. Oh, I don't know. You know, nobody's seen the back of his hands lately. That's probably what the doctors keep cutting off of his face is the little 666s that keep popping up on. Oh, Jesus, there's another one. We got to cut it away. Get the laser.
Read something a while ago. I hope it's not true. It said that Wednesday Have you heard this, that Obama's choosing his vice president?
Say again.
What's his name, Birch Bay?
Oh, Evan Bay. Evan Bay.
Evan Bay.
You said Birch. I think Birch Beer, you know. You know how I am.
I said no.
Evan Bay is a non-starter for me. Sam Nunn is a non-starter for me.
Well, Bay, you know, he wouldn't, if they, whoever debates with the other vice president, he'd be worse than Lieberman.
How could you tell? You'd be asleep by the time he got
yeah,
"Hello, my name is" out of his mouth. Yeah.
And he's a blue dog. Absolutely.
Yes, in terms of ideological points, Juanita, and in terms of making sense, just in having all the right credentials, I'll tell you somebody I like a lot, and that's Jack Reed from Rhode Island.
Yeah.
Now, you're never going to get anybody to make any political, consultant or anything able to make a case of, you know, we really need to bring in the Rhode Island vote. But he's got, Jack Reed from Rhode Island has everything right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everything is in perfect place. He's got the military creds. He's got the liberal creds. He has walked the walk and talked the talk. And he doesn't mind calling BS when he smells it.
Right. And Birch Bayh, I mean, gee. Well, they didn't mean it like that. You know, he gave them all kind of excuses. And then the people would say, oh, that's the kind of debate we need.
Yeah, Evan Bayh, the Hoosier Lieberman.
Yeah.
Now, there's a question for 2008. Who's your Lieberman? Who's your Lieberman? Evan Bayh is.
Right. And another one I like is Wes Clark.
I like Wes, too, but if you're going to go that route, then why not go with Jack Reed? Because
I know, but you know what I'm saying? There's a number of really good ones without having to go to this guy.
The one that sort of gives me the queasies lately is all the press that Tim Kaine has been getting. Yeah, that guy gives me the creeps. I mean, Tim Kaine, governor of...
Somebody like that.
But here's a guy who doesn't believe that a woman's got enough sense to control her own insides.
Really?
Oh, yeah, Tim Kaine's big old pro-lifer.
Lord, we don't need him.
Here's a guy who is a Democrat and yet is shoving nasty old coal-fired power plants down the people of his own state's throat for all he's worth. Oh, yeah. You know, don't forget, they're doing mountaintop removal in Virginia, too, Juanita, and he's turned a blind eye on that.
Well, I think he's come out for it, what I've read, something like that. He's for that. But anyway, I'll tell you what I saw on The View last week. I'm sure you heard about it, something about it. On Thursday, Whoopi announced that the Obama people said that he did not give them permission to print that prayer. And she said, that's all we're going to say about it. But then she showed the ad with Paris Hilton and what's the other girl's name?
Britney Spears.
Yeah, Britney Spears. And that's what set them off. And, of course, a little bit, you know, she had to get her points in, you know, and... that he had put himself out in the public and he was just going to have to take it. And
he's going to have to tolerate whatever kind of sleazy filth the pig licking party wants to throw his way.
And then Joy Behar, she showed a picture of John McCain and, you know, the guy that rides a horse and advertises medical supplies.
Oh, Wilfred Brimley? Yeah, bless his heart. Every time that thing came on, my dad would look at the TV and go to blazes, Wilfred. To the point that when they were little, our children learned to say that, too.
And then what, got Elizabeth off, she said, well, if you're going to go talking about friends, that's his friend. She said, what about Obama? Him and Red and White. And the guy that's in trouble in Illinois.
Tony Rezko, sure.
Yeah, and then she said, he just won't let me say anything. And she just takes over. But, and then when they came back from the commercial, they said, you know, we really do love each other. We're not mad at each other. But I've seen some times.
Horse feathers.
That's come close, huh?
Horse feathers, they love each other. Just on the little bit I've seen and what you've told us about, I can well imagine there are times where if looks could kill, little Miss Hasselbeck would go out of the room in a basket.
Yeah. By Oprah and, Whoopi and Sherry.
Yeah, and by the way, I was listening to the guy the other day. I didn't realize this because I'm not all plugged in.
Yeah, I wanted to tell you that.
What's Elizabeth's claim to fame? She won some reality show or something?
She was on Survival Show.
Oh.
And then she married her husband is a football player.
Right. Right.
I think with the Giants. I don't know.
Yeah, Matt Hasselbeck.
And
Seahawks, maybe?
She comes from a psychological family or something. Her parents are psychologists or something like that.
Oh, I thought you were going to say she comes from a psychotic family, and I was going to say that I can believe.
All right, there you go again, talking about psychotics.
I know. When I myself am one, you know?
I am. Me too. I'm a controlled psychologist. Psychotic under control. Oh, by the way, that guy that was supposed to kill himself—he was in the mental hospital. How did he get all those Tylenol and codeine?
Well, there's that, and there's a million other questions. That's why I'm looking forward to our conversation with Brad so much.
Yeah. Good. But
I'm already hearing from one of our buddies, William, just chimed in, and he said, my first gut reaction on Ivins is the parallel between him and the D.C. madam who we were told hung herself in her mother's shed in Florida after leaving two suicide notes.
Right.
And then then the story just went poof, gone, never to be heard from again.
Right.
They're
not going to even have an autopsy on this man.
Shucks, no, everybody knows. Yeah, heck.
Uh-huh.
I mean,
and
it's
and close the case.
It's the same thing with the terrorist attack in Knoxville on the Unitarians. There are a million questions that remain out there about that attack. If there's one, there's a million, and it's off the radar. It's gone. Sorry that these are not the droids you're looking for. Right. These are not the droids we're looking for. Move along now.
Yeah.
So,
it's like toward the end of the term that they're going to try to get a few things done.
This is... but the Ivins case is particularly disturbing, especially in light of what I found out today, which...
you're going to discuss?
Yeah, which we will discuss.
Yeah. I've heard quite a bit about it, too. But probably not as much as.
Well, we got kind of a scoop here because we've got information that nobody else has, well, information that nobody else will bother to look for because that wouldn't be nice.
Mm-hmm. Rush Limbaugh's got a fantastic assessment of Barack. Oh, man.
Oh, what? Is he out there playing Barack the Magic Negro again, or has he got a new one?
No, he's talking about him. He's so arrogant, and this and that and the other. He's taking that ad and adding his own slant to it.
Nice. Classy guy.
But I want to know, did you find that song by Johnny Cash?
No, I did not.
You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, God will cut you down. It's a good song. Because I just feel that song when I hear Rush Limbaugh. All these people that are doing all these things, and some of them are doing it in God's name, and I don't think God likes that too much.
Well, I wish he'd get on the stick a little bit more.
right.
Yeah, I don't know if he's off doing his rounds halfway across the universe or something, but there's some folks desperately needing lightning bolts here. You know, just
yeah.
If as the right-wing fundamentalist ministers say that he can send a hurricane to wipe out a gay pride parade, you'd think he could take a man that's spewed as much filth and hate in 20 years as Flush Flimball, and you know, that maybe he'd be worth a tornado, you know, or a lightning bolt, you know, a bunch of drag queens that never hurt anybody, but Limbaugh gets away. You know,
well, it says it's a fearful thing to fall in the hands of the living God, and, when you're using God's name in vain, and I believe that's what it is.
My friends, I have talent on loan from God.
Yeah.
You know, I've got a buddy who every time he hears that screams, margin call!
But anyway, that I just wanted to get in touch with you. And
well, human events. Is that it? Yeah, the right-wing rag that's not fit to put in the bottom of a birdcage. Human events celebrated 20 glorious years of Rush Limbaugh last week.
What's the name of it?
Human events.
I never heard.
Yeah, it's a right-wing piece of garbage. It's a magazine. And really, honest to God, I would not defame a canary by putting that filthy thing in the bottom of its cage.
But I bet you.
But, wait, just a minute, Juanita. What I was saying, they celebrated last week with full knowledge, mind you, that a right-wing, radio-listening, hate-consuming madman had gone into a church and killed two people and wounded eight others. With full knowledge of that, they had an orgy last week celebrating the conservative works of Rush Limbaugh.
Oh.
Waving a red flag in front of the universal bull, I don't know what is. I mean, that's like, here I am, lightning bolt, come on!
He's really gone way over on this. Part of it I heard on, I think it was on John Cartman's show. Forgot what I was going
to
say.
No, that's okay. It happens to the best of us. we're gonna see more of what happened in Knoxville. You and I both know it.
Yeah. But
and the shame of that is that we don't have the guts to ask why it's happening.
But they're just getting more and more obnoxious.
Oh, well, see, that's part of the racket, Juanita. They have to get more and more obnoxious. When all you've got is incitement and invective to offer to an audience, then you have to keep upping the ante. You have to keep making the act bigger. You have to keep making the allegations broader. You have to keep making the hate deeper. You have to make the venom more concentrated and more potent in order to succeed. And that's what you get with Limbaugh and Savage and Hannity and O'Reilly and all of these people, is that all they do, all in the world they do, is try to constantly one-up themselves. You know, that's why you've got, God almighty, what was it, 2 weeks ago, that the son of Ronald Reagan called for a man.
The oldest one.
Yeah, Michael.
Called for
a man to be taken out in the street and murdered. Not just any man, a specific man.
Maybe that's what inspired this guy, too. You know, besides the books.
Well, it's clearly what inspired him. He was a right-wing radio listener. This guy was losing everything he had. He was down to losing his food stamps, Juanita.
Right. Right.
And as a consequence, he decided to lash out at the world and at the people that the last communication means that he had, good old free public airwaves AM radio, He was going to lash out at the people that those geniuses on the AM radio had been telling him was responsible for his problems. And he did.
He sure did.
And yet we're hearing nothing about it. You know, by now the man should have had a preliminary hearing, which means there should be significant evidence of record somewhere in Tennessee. Is there any for-profit journalist out there willing to go and pursue that information? Not that I've seen.
Yeah.
No.
They don't care, for one thing.
No, they don't care, but there's also the other.
It doesn't face them.
They don't care, and they don't dare, Juanita. Okay? I mean, consider we've already had Luke from Knoxville sort of give us the 411 on the nature of the sheriff and the police chief and everything down there. They're a bunch of right-wing conservatives, too. So even though Adkisson may have been mad as a hatter, he is also one of them, and they are movement conservatives, and they're going to protect the movement at all costs.
Yeah. That's kind of like the three white guys that drugged the black guy to death in Texas a few years ago.
Yes.
The hometown boy, he got a life sentence. The others got... Death.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So, you know, they were looking after their own.
But we don't pay attention to stuff like this, Juanita. And even on our side, if you start pointing this stuff out, there are liberals and there are progressives. I've seen them in the blogosphere since this happened, who will say, yeah, it's really not fair to talk about, it's not fair to talk about whether or not these people were conservatives. Being a killer and being a conservative is not the same thing. Kumbaya. Let's all sing Kumbaya now.
Yeah.
And if you ignore one of the critical elements of the profile of a mass murderer, well, you're just begging for it to happen again. You know, so many people forget. Maybe they didn't know in the first place because we just ignored the dickens out of it. So many people don't know, Juanita, that the Rwandan genocide was...
No, they don't.
...that was fulminated by talk radio over there.
Yeah.
They had talk radio people on the air saying the same kinds of things that Michael Reagan and Sean Hannity and Bill O'Reilly and Rush Limbaugh and Michael Savage... all say.
Yeah.
And those people acted on it, and that's how the genocide got into a full boil. Now, is there anybody, well, that could never happen. You know, I'm one of those people that believes in never using the word never.
Right. I've always had to eat it.
Yeah. And words. There's a YouTube video out there I saw not too long back. It's called The Wisdom of Limbaugh or Limbaugh's Wisdom or something like that. And it's a catalog of all the right-wing killers who had distinct, definite, traceable associations between their murderous acts and their propensity for listening to right-wing hate radio.
Uh-huh.
And they're just cataloged.
And they do keep people stirred up.
Well, it's part of the racket. They have to.
Right.
If you're not keeping people stirred up, if you're not sitting there just needling them to death while they're sitting in traffic, well, you're not worth $20 million a year.
No.
Or 40.
Well, he's earning his money now, I guess.
Well, I personally, you ever seen the movie Marathon Man?
No, I haven't. I know what it's about. I sort of what it's about.
Well, there's this...
Dennis,
the evil Nazi dentist played by Laurence Olivier and Dustin Hoffman plays
mm-hmm.
the victim. There's this scene where the evil Nazi dentist has to eat the diamonds he's been after. And, yeah, I would be lying if I didn't say that it would be pleasant to watch Hannity or Savage or... Limbaugh have to chow down on some of their millions, preferably in gold.
Yeah.
Seeing as how they got so many buy gold now commercials running on their shows. But that's just me being mean, and I don't advocate for anybody to go make them do it.
I don't want anybody.
No, it's just a little fantasy.
Yeah.
But see, these guys don't deal in fantasy. They actually call, like Michael Reagan did, they call for a man to, a specific individual
that... He's by the bullets.
Yeah.
He said he'd buy the bullets.
Yeah, yeah. Somebody, what was it? Michael Reagan said, somebody go kill Mark Dice. I'll buy the bullets.
Yeah. Yeah. He sure did.
And then he had the guy on his show and apologized to him. Well, I'm sorry. You know what? As we've noted before, time after time after time, Juanita, you can't unring a bell.
No. Nope. Sure can't.
And these freaks have, there are consequences to the actions that these freaks undertake.
Before I go, I just want to tell you something I thought was kind of funny. You were talking about Guy.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about the View last week. And I was listening to him, and he said, I don't know what kind of idiot would watch that show.
Oh, God.
It was storming here, and I could have called him and said, I do, and Bob makes me do it.
Oh, that's right. Blame me, Juanita.
Well, I thought that was so funny. He said, I wonder who in the world.
The Bob Devil made me do it. Yeah, okay. Yeah, see, that's the pernicious influence of liberal talk radio. We make people watch television programs. The other people makes people go out and shoot folks.
Yeah, right.
Yep. Blame me. You ought to be ashamed of yourself.
Yep.
Well, Juanita, I appreciate you calling in, and I will remember that, if I have a conversation with Guy, I'll remind him that you watch The View and that you do it specifically at our behest.
They're on rerun this week too. So.
Oh, then we're safe for a little bit.
Yeah, Obama was on today. It was a rerun of that. But anyway.
Well, have yourself a wonderful evening, Juanita.
You too.
All right. We'll try. You take care.
Okay, good night.
Bye now. Our View correspondent, Juanita, calling from Florida. You know, something occurred to me during the long silence that is otherwise known as the weekend. All these things come into my head, and they go out of my head. Some stick, some don't. But I was reminded of one of the things that came with broadcast deregulation. And that is the idea of licensing. Once upon a time, back when I used to ride my dinosaur down to the studio every day, once upon a time, there were three licenses. There was the big license, and the mama license, and the baby license. And they were all issued by the Federal Communications Commission, Washington, D.C., the FCC. And if you crawled behind a microphone at any point in time, you had to have at least the little baby license, because it was just right for young broadcasters. I had one of those. I faithfully took it with me when I left my first radio job. You take it down from the wall there, and you put it in your wallet, and when you get your next radio job, you pin it back up on the wall at the news station. When you leave there, or if you're fired, you take the card down and you pin it back on the wall at the next radio station. And so on and so forth. Because that way there was some level of accountability for the people who were actually broadcasting over the public airwaves. Especially if you were producing yourself or you were jocking yourself or you were the licensee who was in charge of that station's overall license during the period of time in which you were on the air. Now, you had to have the Class A or Class 1 or A1A license or whatever it was. And that was the one where you had to sit down and know all kinds of funky mathematics and formulas that had squiggly symbols in them and stuff that I never, no, wasn't gonna. But you at least had to have that little wallet card license in order to broadcast. And that all went away with deregulation, and suddenly it wasn't necessary to have your little FCC license hanging on the wall anymore. I remember folks Granted, it didn't cost a lot of money. I don't think it cost any. Maybe postage. But you sent it off to the FCC, and they stamped on it, and they waved a magic wand over it, and then it said, holy smoot, and sent it back to you. And it was, there you go. All wrapped up tight and shiny. And you were a licensed FCC broadcaster. Your buddy over at McDonald's couldn't say that he was a licensed hamburger mechanic. No, he would have to wait till the advent of the Bush administration to say that he was a licensed hamburger mechanic after the Bush administration rewrote the rules that said that fast food workers were industrial production workers. But you could say you were a real live, honest-to-God FCC licensed broadcaster. And that little card, for as tiny as it was, carried a whole boatload of responsibility. It meant that, in fact, you could not say any old thing you wanted to on the air, that you had to be respectful of the fact that the airwaves did not belong to you, that you were, in fact, performing a service that was intimately attached to the public good. That what you were doing was a function of the freedom of the United States of America. That you, by possessing that little sort of tan-colored card with the print on both sides and the FCC stamp on it, that you were, in fact, a guardian of the public trust. Because the public airwaves are, or were, in fact, a public trust. And that comes with that, that's some heady stuff. Whether you're 16 years old or whether you're 60 years old. But see, that life support system for a haircut, the Hannity job, Flush Flemball, O'Reilly, Savage, none of these ass clowns have to have that little card anymore. Even if I was on terrestrial radio, I wouldn't have to have that card anymore. I don't have to have one. Even if they were still in force, I wouldn't have to have one here because we're not operating on the public airwaves. The FCC has no jurisdiction over Internet radio. But I couldn't help reflecting on that aspect of so-called deregulation. I couldn't help reflecting on the fact that part of why Michael Reagan, for instance, can call for the outright assassination of someone with whom he has a political difference of opinion, couldn't help reflecting on the fact that he's able to do that because he feels no relationship between him and, in fact, a public trust. Because the airwaves are not, for right-wing blowhards, a public trust. They are a cash cow to be milked. They are a goose whose golden eggs are there to be filched. And the cow and the goose are yet owned, at least in name, by you and me. But not in the sick and twisted, fetid, swampy places that pass for the minds of a right-wing gasbag blowhard. Public trust is a dirty word to them. Why, it's the free market. The airwaves exist for me to make a fortune on. Didn't you see my contract signed last week? 20 million smackers. How public does that look to you? You think you're getting any of it? Screw off. And so I could not help noting the degree to which that little bitty card made all the difference in the world. It implied accountability. It implied that the license could be taken away and you, therefore, could not be a broadcaster anymore. Now the only hope that we have, the only thing that stands between us and, you know, just more filth on the public airwaves from the Hannitys and the Savages and the Limbaughs and the O'Reillys and the like of the world, is the so-called free market. And what I stated at the beginning of the program is very, very true. Insofar as advertisers wouldn't care if Sean Hannity, Michael Savage, and Bill O'Reilly were playing in a jug band with one guy on the spoons, one guy on the saw, one guy on the jug, Limbaugh on the jug, another guy on the washboard, and maybe Neil Bortz yodeling. The advertisers wouldn't care as long as that miserable ensemble was delivering enough potential suckers to buy their products. So no standard of public service will take care of, will guardian our public airwaves. No standard of decency. No standard of accuracy. The only thing, the guardian of the public airwaves has been turned into the so-called free market. And as long as the free market can buy gold now or sell vacuum cleaners that pick up bowling balls or Swedish mattresses with NASA space-age foam technology or herbal baldness cures, as long as the free market can hustle some of that to a dim-witted potential purchaser somewhere, then no matter if they're calling for a person to be shot in the back of the head or the front of the head, no matter if they're calling for women to be murdered outright, no matter if they're advocating all of these things are actual facts, no matter if they're advocating for the bombing of abortion clinics, no standard of law, no standard of decency, no standard of accountability will be applied to these ministers of hatred and vitriol who own and control the American airwaves as we now understand them. The only thing that controls, the only thing that obtains, is the free market. Yeehaw! Hey, Ethel, come look here. They got them a remedy here, says we'll be getting it on like when we as teenagers. We better order some. Here's the 800 number. Yeah. That's where we are in 2008. And, of course, the right wing is selling magazines for all it's worth on it, you know, Newsmuck and the Human Events and World Nut Daily and so forth. Oh, the war on Rush Limbaugh, the war on the war on talk radio. Oh, they want to take away the only media that isn't liberal. Gets kind of hard to stomach sometimes. Kind of? Nah, it gets real hard to stomach sometimes. Whether it's, you know, and the outright lying. Jiminy Christmas. Did you run across this one? The one where, this has to do with that stupid, hateful book, I believe, out by the same guy who did Swiftboat Veterans for Truth. Jerome Corsi, that piece of human excrescence. They've actually, with not even so much as a grin, a sardonic grin on their faces, this Jerome Corsi piece of filth has claimed that Senator Barack Obama said, and I quote, well, never mind. Check out the audio for yourself.
You go through every position that he has as on the fringe of the left wing, the fringe of the Democratic Party.
Even extensively looking back at his record when he was in the state legislature in Illinois, his completely pro-abortion position.
Even if a child was born.
Even if a child was born, he said the woman still had the right to kill the child in an abortion.
You go into Obama's far-left domestic policy.
Now, this is, like I said, this is from, of course, that life support system for a haircut. This is astonishing. Made all the more so when you realize that there are, in fact, a significant number of Americans, just like Jim Adkison in Tennessee, who listen to this filth and believe it to be true. Not know, but believe, because they don't do anything with the knowing part of their brain. They operate entirely on with their, you know, we talk about the lizard brain from time to time. Right-wingers have a Tinkerbell part of their brain. They use the Tinkerbell brain to do all their believing with. That's right. That's right. After a child's born, Obama in Illinois State Senate wanted the child killed if the mother desired an abortion. Obama's on the record as let's kill the baby if that's what the mother wants. No, he didn't. Not even remotely. Not even a little bit. Didn't advocate anything in any sort of a way that could be even misconstrued by somebody as dead from the neck up as a conservative. Just didn't. It's not like somebody left a word out somewhere and it changes the meaning. Like if you leave not out of a sentence and it goes from being the negative to the affirmative. No, no. Didn't even say something a little bit like that. But we're talking about repiglickins here, folks. We're talking about conservatives with their family values. And the truth is not something that gets in their way. Facts will never get in the way of their ideology. No. Just can't. Just can't. Because they're repiglickins, and they're in the hateful lion business. So we'll take a little break. I'm going to get Brad Friedman on the line. Looking forward to that conversation. This has become rather of an anthem for some of y'all, and for me as well. The perfect Monday song.
Won't work this morning. I can't punch in. Too many questions under my skin. I did like they told me. I'd settle down. I'm going crazy. time away from all this. I need a drink. What do I do here? Where will I go? Why am I so haunted by anything that I don't know? I need room to take this over. I need a ride out to Horseshoe Lake. I want to feel like it makes a difference. What difference one man makes? They say that one man
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
Yes, you are. Lordy. Will Kimbrough doesn't know how to do a bad song. That is from his EP of a year or so back. The name of that song is Horseshoe Lake. And like I said, it's become kind of an anthem here for some folks listening to the network. A kind of a Monday anthem. And it's become a sort of a shorthand for when things are, you know, getting a little sideways and you just look at somebody who knows what you're talking about and you say, listen, I'll be back. I'm going to Horseshoe Lake. Yeah. WillKimbrough.com. KIMBROUGH.com. Go and support independent music and make yourself really happy with a whole bunch of great, great, great work. Man can play the strings right off a guitar, too. Now, I mentioned at the beginning of the program that we would have, me and that mouse in my pocket, that we would have Brad Friedman on. Brad is, of course, the progenitor and journalist extraordinaire from bradblog.com. And he's been paying attention of late to the ins and outs and the sort of circuitous, tortured reasoning and tormented poor journalism that has been attendant upon the so-called suicide of Bruce Ivins, the Fort Detrick, Maryland biologist who allegedly offed himself in anticipation of being named as the anthrax killer. And I wanted to spend some time with Brad going through that, as well as share some new information that has come to me and which I have shared with Brad today. So let's get Brad on board. Hey, Brad, long time no talk to. Been too long.
It has been too long. How are you, my friend?
You know, if I was any better, I'd be in Florida.
And, well, you know what? Let me add one point here, and I know you don't want to give away your scoop. It's a pretty good one in this case. But that information didn't come to you, my friend. You went out and sought that information, which is something I wish the media was doing a better job of in covering this anthrax report.
Well, I wish the media were doing the, we've got a new word for them, or a new phrase for them we've been using for a while here, and it seems to have stuck kind of nicely. We call them the for-profit media, Brad, because at the end of the day, whether you're talking about, well, most of the so-called mainstream outlets, they're not doing journalism for journalism's sake or to fulfill a constitutional duty. They're doing it to make a buck.
Well, that's true. They are. And while in and of itself, I don't mind that. I mean, people are certainly entitled to make a living. You know, this is, I know that you and myself both sort of work round the clock trying to do this stuff. And it would be nice if we could buy a sandwich and pay the rent every now and again. So, you know, for profit, you got that right. I don't necessarily mind that. What I do mind, however, is when they get the story wrong, when they do what they've done here in this case, as Glenn Greenwald over at Salon has so expertly detailed, that the media basically passes on bad information that they get from anonymous sources. And then when it turns out that that information was untrue, was false, that those reporters were lied to, they don't turn around and expose those anonymous sources for being the liars that they are. And as I mentioned, Greenwald, he's been detailing an extraordinary case where ABC News did exactly that in the early days of this anthrax matter, had reported that there was four separate sources who were able to tie this anthrax back to Iraq, based on tests that showed there was bentonite in the anthrax. And in fact, there never was any bentonite in that anthrax, and it was a completely false report. Yet ABC has never bothered to retract the story, much less expose who were the government liars that gave them that information. That was a crucial piece of information back in those days when the country was marching towards to war, and that tie between anthrax and Iraq was a very crucial point in the Bush administration's case to go to war.
Well, it was indeed, and of course there's no page A37 for ABC to print the retraction on, and the 24/7 news cycle being what it is. Why bother, you know, because not long after that, you know, there'll be somebody getting chewed up by a shark.
Yeah, right. Well, that's true, and it's easy for them to just ignore it. It's getting harder, though, I'm happy to say. A couple of well-respected journalism professors today have joined the now growing drumbeat, calling on ABC to reveal who those sources were, or at the very least, do an investigation and tell us, the people, how they came across, you know, how they came to have this bad information in the first place, and expose it. And in lieu of that, both these journalism professors and Glenn Greenwald are calling for an independent investigation and or congressional hearings to get at the bottom of this. Because we're seeing this, Bob, more and more. You'll recall that it was these anonymous sources that were feeding information to folks like Judith Miller, that was
right,
run on
yeah.
the front page of the New York Times, information given to Bob Novak that resulted in the leaking of a covert CIA operative by our own White House for the first time in history. Those people were also protected. I'm a reporter. I understand the need for confidential sources at times. I try to avoid using them myself, and when I do, I try to get, either independent verification of what they're reporting or some sort of physical documentation to back up their claims. That's not always possible, but more often than not, it is. And if it's not, I won't run the report.
Right, because otherwise you wind up relying on people like, what was his name, Screwball or Curveball or whatever, that was living under the bridge in Iraq somewhere drinking the screw top wine and saying that Saddam was making nuclear weapons, things like that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Curveball, who was fed to Judith Miller.
Right.
And it turned out he knew nothing about what was going on with Saddam Hussein and WMD, but this was given as a source. No one else could check it out. We just sort of had to trust it.
Right. And I mean, when you talk about anonymous sources, I guess the guy I think of right off the bat for being willing to use them is Cy Hirsch. But Cy Hirsch has a long track record such that when he cites an anonymous source, you know, he's not just making it up. Well, you can't say the same thing about an ABC or a CBS or an NBC with this sort of thing. And they got, what was the allegation? You've heard it as many times as I have, Brad, where the right-wingers like to holler, "Well, see, George Bush has been on the job because we ain't been attacked since 9/11.
Yeah,
well,
exactly.
We kind of have been, haven't we? I mean, the anthrax attack was after 9/11, right?
Yes. That has been one of the great lies that is even still used today. You hear John McCain saying, we haven't been attacked on American soil since 9/11. That's a lie. And look, the reporter who disclosed this information for ABC, who made these reports, was Brian Ross, head of their investigative unit. Now, he's a, you know, pretty respected reporter, and I won't go so far as to say that he simply made up these sources. I don't think he would. I've dealt with those guys at ABC. They're, you know, they're pretty good reporters, and they require, you know, the things be backed up and properly vetted and reported out. It sounds to me like someone lied to him. Now,
right.
Had it been me, I would have said, okay, there are tests that shows there was this bentonite in the anthrax, which ties back to Iraq. I would have asked to have seen some of those test reports, but that was, you know, highly classified in the middle of this FBI investigation. I can imagine not getting at it, and I can imagine being satisfied with four different sources that he described as independent. And I, you know, so I believe when Brian Ross came out and reported this stuff, he believed it to be true. He believed that these sources were good. The problem shortly thereafter, really, was that the sources were not good. The information was lies. And in many, many years since then, since we've known that there was no bentonite found in this anthrax and that, in fact, it was tied directly to that Fort Detrick, Maryland facility, our own government facility, ABC has never bothered to either retract the report or point out who these four people were, these separate sources that he, as he claims, that misled him, that lied to him. Now, look, maybe those sources as well were misled by someone else, but that's why it's important to get to the bottom of this, to find out who those people were, who was feeding them information, if somebody was, or if they just made it up. Those are the folks who I'm worried about, and, you know, I think this is a very, very serious point.
Oh, I think it is, Brad, especially in light of the fact that while, what is it, correlation does not imply causation, I believe that's the phrase, we are dealing with an administration that has openly and been caught at manipulating journalists over the years. So is it fair to say if they're willing to do that on one or two or three other levels, why wouldn't they feed bogus information to Brian Ross?
Well, that's exactly right. And that's why we need to know who this, who these reports came from. And, you know, I can only hope they do it and they don't try to do the, you know, this was a confusing issue for me. I remember years ago when they had called Judith Miller in and, were forcing her to expose who her sources were in regard to the Valerie Plame leak. And, you know, at first, my knee-jerk reaction, of course, was to say, well, you know, she's a reporter. She needs to keep her sources secret. Otherwise, no one will trust her to give her these kind of tips in the future. So I do understand that. Then it became clear that it wasn't a matter of protecting sources who had given her information of government wrongdoing. Those sources themselves were the ones committing the wrongdoing because they were doing something illegal, and not just because, many whistleblowers who disclose classified information will do so even though it's illegal, but because they feel that it's in our best interest that, you know, there's government corruption going on or something that the public needs to know. But that was not the case here. The public did not need to know that Valerie Plame was a covert CIA operative. So they were, in fact, where the law was being broken was in that leak itself to her. And that's why that should have been exposed once that became clear. Yet, of course, she chose to protect her sources rather than reveal exactly who they were and how they're lying to her.
And, of course, just to sort of bring things into the present, after the alleged suicide of Bruce Ivins, I got an email from one of our listeners, William, who says, you know, my first gut reaction is to parallel between Ivins and D.C. madam, who we were told hung herself in her mother's shed in Florida and then left suicide notes. And then it just goes completely off the radar. And meanwhile, the highly professional journalism continues with this issue, as you note on today's front page of the Brad blog, with this business of the Washington Post scrubbing its own story and then replacing it and then going back to it? What's happening there? Why?
You know,
is there an editor in the building? It's not is there a doctor in the house? Is there an editor in the house? I mean, somebody, please.
Are there ethics in the house? Are there journalistic 101 ethics in the house? I mean, you know, when I have to make a correction to a story, or if I add information, or in the exceptionally rare instance that a story needs to be retracted, you know, that will be noted publicly and transparently. What the Washington Post did is they had actually a very good report that they ran last Friday asking questions about this Bruce Ivins and whether he even had the ability to create the powdered dry anthrax that was used in these attacks. Now, his colleagues are all saying, no, he had no access to that sort of dry anthrax that the it was only liquid anthrax that they used at the Fort Detrick facility. And the Washington Post did a very good report questioning that, quoting other experts who agreed that Ivins would have had no access to that dry powdered anthrax. It was a notable report on Friday, you know, in the hullabaloo as this was all being reported. I picked it up at Brad Blog, and then a reader pointed out, hey, Brad, that information you quoted from the Washington Post is no longer there. It's been replaced by a completely different story, and there was no explanation.
But it was replaced under a completely different story under the same URL, right?
Yeah, which is really bizarre. I mean, they scrubbed that story. Now, I, you know, probably would have reported it with capital letters and a flashing siren once I noted it, had I not then noticed on Sunday morning that, in fact, they were running yet another story on Sunday that revisited a lot of those concerns that they had brought up in that Friday story. So the reason for that scrubbing of the Friday story still remains a mystery to me right now, but at least the information is finally getting out that, look, there are some serious questions about the government's case in this matter. And as they have screwed it up before with Steve Hatfill, you'll remember that he was the other guy who was initially accused of this. He was exonerated, and he settled just last month for something like $5.8 million.
And I can't help but be sort of impressed with the timing of all this, Brad. I mean, call me paranoid, but, you know, they settle one, and all of a sudden, oh, we solved it. I mean,
yeah. Well, and they hadn't even been prepared. You know, the initial reports made it look like he was, you know, that day going to be indicted or a day or two later. Now we're seeing in a report in the New York Times today, which notes another key point that we began to report on over the weekend, is that this case seems to be entire, as of now, it looks to be entirely circumstantial and largely hinging on one woman's testimony. That woman and that testimony itself is increasingly bizarre.
You're talking about the so-called therapist?
That's right.
This may seem a little snarky on my part, Brad, but with regard to the therapist, I ran over to the Smoking Gun, smokinggun.com, and I hauled up the pleadings for her protective order. Have you looked at those physical documents?
I have not gotten to see those physical documents. I've seen some others concerning what is actually her criminal record that she has. But let me not sidetrack you from those.
Well, no, I was just this is, I'm one of those people that believes that there is a totality of things when you're investigating something that until you can absolutely remove them from consideration as a potential consideration of the totality of the circumstance, that you have to look at everything. And I looked at these pleadings where she's applying for this protective order, and I also showed them to my lovely wife Agnes, who has had some experience in the mental health field, and she said, "Good Lord, these look like the scrawlings of a fifth grader."
Yeah, that's what I did see them reported on as being, you know, hand-scrawled and, you know, really adding more questions than answers to the case as far as how the government could hinge their what seems to be their entire case on this woman. you know, she also made some claims in those pleadings, and I haven't seen the, as you said, that actual hand-scrawled pleadings, but in her testimony to the judge, she noted that he was making claims of revenge murders and, you know, that he was going to go out, quote, in a blaze of glory. Everybody out with him?
Yeah, he had guns. He had a gun and a Kevlar vest.
That's right.
And that he was going to kill women.
Right, exactly. And yet you'll notice none of those targeted, by the way, in the anthrax letters were actually women. They were all men. But that some of those claims, according to this woman, came during group therapy sessions. Now, that means there ought to be other folks in those group therapy sessions who could testify as to whether this is true or not, whether these claims actually even happened. I'm starting to wonder. This woman has a criminal record. She's been arrested several times driving under the influence, for drug possession. Some very bizarre stuff.
Well, consider this language in and of itself, Brad. I'm looking at the hand scrawled document right now.
Yeah.
And I take where possible, I try not to play Beatles records backwards, as the case may be. I try to take language for what it is. Now listen to this and see what you make of it. Client has a history dating to his graduate days of homicidal threats, actions, plans, threats and actions toward therapist. Now, that either means that she is alleging that she's been treating him since his graduate days, or that she has before her his entire psychiatric history.
Well, there was information that apparently was given to her once Ivins was committed to this mental facility. Apparently, this woman, Dooley is her name, was given information from previous psychiatric studies of this guy. And I can only guess she's referring to that, you know, to the information that she was given from other therapists, not on what she was, information that she was given firsthand.
And, you know, there's an allegation here where she contends that the respondent has engaged in a malicious course of conduct, you know, it's one of those check-the-box forms, has approached or pursued you with intent to place you in reasonable fear, in other words, stalking. And, you know, at best, she says that he's made a phone call.
Mm-hmm.
Now, listen, I am as sensitive as anybody out there to issues relating to stalking. However, this just seems terribly, terribly flimsy, Brad.
Yep.
Yeah, you're right. In that, let's go back on that. They do create the impression that, you know, oh, well, you know, the indictment will be out day after tomorrow. But the New York Times story makes clear that it's circumstantial and that the grand jury was going to hear evidence for weeks?
For at least another 2 weeks. So, I mean, I guess in the scope of things, this has been ongoing and unsolved for 7 years. Maybe 2 weeks is considered soon in those terms. But, you know, the government's going to have to release their case on this thing. And I suspect they're also going to then fight that and say, well, you know, we can't release everything because it's classified.
National security.
But, you know, the bottom line here is that if, in fact, Ivins was either driven to commit suicide because of the relentless pressure by the FBI, or he committed suicide for other reasons, or he was suicided, as some folks, you know, like to refer to it, in any case, they better damn well make the case that this was the guy. Otherwise, it means the anthrax killer is still out there running around. And if they're going to announce case closed on this thing, you know, just to loop back, if I have a second.
No, take all the time you need. That's the beauty of this.
Well, I've got the a blog item open in front of me that I think needs to be kept in mind when looking at this case and looking how much of it is hanging on this Dooley character and her testimony. Now, Meryl Nass was a former colleague of Ivins, and she's a bioterrorism expert. She's a physician and so forth. And looking at the testimony that Dooley had given to the judge, Meryl Nass wrote this. and we quoted this over at Brad Blog. She says, as a physician who is called to assess psychiatric patients presenting to the ER, I find Dooley's statements troubling. If any of the psychiatrists diagnosed Ivins as homicidal, that physician would be required to start immediate proceedings for psychiatric hospital commitment. Patients who are a danger to themselves or others must not be allowed to carry out such activities. That is the law. Furthermore, if Dooley believed Ivins had attempted serial murders, she would be required to consult with her supervising physician and immediately call in the police. Was this done? Who was poisoned? Because she claims that he had tried to poison people. If, as reported, she had only been treating Ivins for 6 months, what evidence did she have of these more remote attacks that she's claiming? I mean, this thing, you know, I hate to go all Nancy Grace on you here. CNN.
Well, listen, I trust you to go Nancy Grace more than I trust Nancy Grace to go Nancy Grace.
Well, she's a former attorney. I'm not, but I'm looking at this case, and I mean, it just seems to be paper, tissue paper thin. And now, beyond that, as I started doing originally, and as I think piqued your notice as well, we begin to look at the political affiliations of this guy. Those don't seem to really add up. And furthermore, why is nobody looking at that? When you have these letters that were clearly,
That's the thing. They're all mailed from, a common area in New Jersey around Princeton, right?
Yep, that's right.
And, Princeton is how far from Fort Detrick, Maryland? You know, 4 hour drive?
That's correct.
Yeah. Nobody can place Ivins there.
Mm-hmm.
That part of it's flimsy. It's that what you mentioned about the dry as opposed to the wet anthrax spores with which, and in fact, I guess it was Meredith Vieira who did an interview on the Today Show this morning about some of this. I saw a clip of it earlier. Where they were talking about the wet versus dry issue. There's the issue of the so-called Ames strain, which was destroyed early in the process, if I understand correctly, which could have led to some degree of resolution. And then finally, you get to the issue of who these things went to. Now, for instance, the people at, I guess what, the New York Post and the Inquirer who got it, Those were cross-contaminated articles in the mails. Is that safe to say?
Well, no, actually, they were targeted. There was a letter sent to the New York Post and to the Inquirer. The people that got killed along the way, though, the woman in Connecticut,
right.
The postal workers were, yeah, because of the aerosolization, apparently, of the dry powdered anthrax.
So, but you wind up with you wind up with the New York Post, and you wind up with the National Enquirer, but then most notably, Tom Daschle, Tom Brokaw, and Pat Leahy.
That's right.
All of whom are treated by the right wing as some sort of screaming liberals, whether it be Brokaw as a member of the liberal media,
mm-hmm.
or Daschle, who was referred to during the period of time when he was Senate Majority Leader as the obstructionist in chief by the likes of Rush Limbaugh, or Pat Leahy, who wouldn't give good judicial nominees an up or down vote. Now, there's no getting away from the so-called liberal flavor of these targets, right?
Well, it sure seems damned obvious, and you know the fact that the only government officials who were targeted were Democrats, and as you recall, this was not long after Jim Jeffords had left the Republican Party. He gave control of the Senate then to the Democrats, and Daschle was at the time the majority leader, and Leahy was the powerful chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, who would be crucial in, either passing or blocking the Patriot Act, which the Bush administration was at that point trying to push through, in addition, you know, towards trying to get Congress to declare war so they could, go to war in Afghanistan, Iraq, and everywhere else. So these were two key players, Daschle and Leahy. No other government officials were targeted, as far as we know. And yet all of the media reports that came out on Friday failed to note what seemed to me to be a pretty crucial and obvious point. And as I argued in one of the articles that I wrote on this at bradblog.com on Friday, you know, if Karl Rove and Tom DeLay and Bill O'Reilly had been the targets of these attacks, do you suppose the media would have picked up that point and reported that the attacks had been sent against, you know, so-called conservatives?
Oh, there would have been, by my estimation, Brad, there would have been no let-up between then and now. We would have heard about it every day. The search, you know, the search for the conservative killer goes on.
Well, that's right. It probably would have been solved by now had that been the case.
Well, there's that too.
I don't
yeah.
know that it would have been solved because, frankly, whoever was the perpetrator here, you know, I hate this story. Let me make that clear. I hate this story because, frankly, you know, that Brad Blog. We have been, as you know, we cover issues of election integrity, election fraud, and I hate this notion where I report something and people run out and say, oh, Brad Blog has another conspiracy theory. I have never reported a conspiracy theory in my life.
I know you well, Brad, and I know that to be true.
You know, what I report is documented, is information you can check out for yourself. You know, not wild-eyed conspiracy theories and anonymous sources like ABC News. Everything I report, you know, can be proven. That said, here I am again working on a story that can easily be, you know, thrown into the tinfoil hat bin. So, frankly, I was delighted to see that folks like Glenn Greenwald over at Salon and Washington Post were asking these very same questions because you have to wonder – who did this? The strain, as you pointed out, was tied to our own bio-terror Army medical research facility. This was someone involved in our own government who did this. So
it smacks of the very definition of a so-called false flag.
It does, doesn't it?
Now compare that, and I know how up you are on the news, so I'm sure I'm not dropping anything on you that you haven't heard. But compare that with the video of Cy Hirsch talking about part of his story about the Iraq run up and the potential Iran run up that has been spiked by the New Yorker, and that is his allegation of a conversation in the vice president's office. Suggesting how to get a war hotted up real good with Iran. Are you familiar with this? Where the vice president and six or seven people in the office suddenly come up with the genius notion that they will dress up some American SEALs as Iranian Revolutionary Guardsmen, put them in little Zodiac rafts, have them zip around an aircraft carrier, blow them out of the water, call them Iranians, and start the war.
They were willing to kill their own people, kill our own people, to help further their political agenda. That's what that bottom line of that story is.
Yeah, it is, and it is. I hate that the way you hate this story.
Yeah.
Because it's really pit of your gut sickening, isn't it, Brad?
There's another question that is coming out now related to this anthrax case that similarly goes straight into Dick Cheney's office. And let me see if I can grab it here. Yeah, Glenn Greenwald asks, I believe this was today. Why was Cheney given Cipro? Remember, this is the antibiotic.
Well, I was going to mention that earlier. Cheney and Bush and a lot of them were started on Cipro, 2 weeks before the anthrax attacks?
Well, as it's reported here, Glenn Greenwald has it, was given Cipro on the night of the 9/11 attacks, and he was allegedly, quote, convinced that he had been subjected to a lethal dose of anthrax on October 18. And that's the fear that led him to seek refuge in the undisclosed locations and so on and so forth. But, yeah, White House aides were given Cipro weeks before the anthrax attack. On the night of September 11 attacks, this is from Washington Post, the White House Medical Office dispensed Cipro to staff accompanying Vice President Dick Cheney as he was secreted off to the safety of Camp David. What the hell is going on here, Bob?
Oh, I know, and I I do remember all of this stuff, Brad. I remember the national debate that then took place with the people in the mainstream media, or the for-profit media, whatever you want to call them, saying, now don't run out and ask your doctor for Cipro, because we can't, but we don't have a national Cipro supply sufficient to give everybody a Cipro pill. And then we had a week of debate on the air about why do we have a Cipro gap? I remember all of that, Brad. It's like it was yesterday to me. This is like having a new wound open up in many ways.
Or
an old wound.
What you don't remember, because it was not reported by the media, is that there was members of the media, including Robert Cohen, who was told, and I don't know that he's ever disclosed who told him, but he was told that he should start taking Cipro. And forgive me, I can't remember if he reported that was before 9/11. I know it was certainly before the anthrax attacks, but someone there had told him, oh, you ought to start taking Cipro right now, and apparently he did. And, you know, setting aside the ethical questions of, you know, should he have reported that to the American people?
Well, there is that, isn't there? Yes.
Take Cipro. You know, there's another question. Who told him that? How did they know that? Why did they know that? I mean, this thing is just unbelievable, the amount of new questions that are now coming out of this case. It's remarkable.
And I to go back to what you said earlier, I don't believe that this is a manifestation of a conspiracy theory to simply ask for straightforward answers to relatively straightforward questions. What, you know, why were people told, you know, why were high government officials told to take Cipro? Well, you know, whether it was Dick Cheney or anybody else. Why isn't there a photograph of Colin Powell at the UN holding up a little vial?
That's right, little vial of anthrax. It wasn't really anthrax, but it was a prop meant to look like anthrax. It meant to scare the crap out of the American people.
Right.
When he made this presentation and about going, you know, trying to convince the world that we should go to war against Iraq, and it worked. And this tie, this holding up this vial in the UN, this comment from Bush in his 2003 State of the Union address, also tying Iraq to anthrax, this all served to scare the crap out of people and, you know, bring support to the notion of going to war against Iraq. I mean, if this government didn't do it, boy, they couldn't have asked for a better gift than what they got via these anthrax attacks. And just to further beat up on the corporate media, I saw Eric Lichtblau, who's actually a decent reporter. He writes for the New York Times. He's a front pager there. Saw him over the weekend on C-SPAN's Washington Journal. And one caller after another was calling in about this anthrax business and the ABC News business and the tie to Iraq and the March of War. Lichtblau was completely clueless about it and felt that, oh, he didn't think that any ties to Iraq were made of any note that had any consequences with this anthrax. And I was just beside myself because people were also asking, I guess Olbermann must have run this clip, but John McCain himself was on David Letterman back before the war.
Yes, he was.
John McCain tied the anthrax to Iraq. Where did he get that information? I mean, you know, I'm in a, let me do a plug here. There's a wonderful documentary that's out right now called Uncounted, The New Math of American Elections. And I'll plug it. You can see the teaser at uncountedthemovie.com. It's been screening around the country. You can get a DVD. I'm in it, for full disclosure, but it's a good movie anyway. That said, there's a comment that one of the women, and forgive me, I can't remember her name, actually makes in the movie, who says, you know, no one has sufficiently explained to me the difference between a conspiracy and a long-range business plan.
Ain't that, yeah.
Boy, I see, that's just, you know.
Well, yeah, conspiracy's gotten a bad rap, frankly. It's charged somewhere in America every day. And there's probably a guilty plea on it somewhere in America every day.
Well, and it's someone in the Republican Party or in the White House who is pleading guilty to it. I mean, the number of folks who have been indicted and jailed on conspiracy in this administration, yeah, these are conspiracy theories because there were conspiracies like crazy, and they continue to this day. And I think this Amtrak case, I mean, if this was a lone loon, and let's go ahead for a moment and say that it was some guy who just got the idea that he needed to do this, somehow had access to this anthrax, although so far nobody can explain how even the folks at Fort Detrick could have had a powdered version of this stuff. Even if it was a lone guy acting, obviously there was folks within the government who then took that information and used it to their advantage, which, you know, even though they knew it wasn't true, even though they knew it wasn't tied to Iraq, long after they knew that it came out of our own facilities, they were still busy out there tying it to Iraq. To me, that's
a crime.
Extraordinary. And it would be a crime, I would think. But again, I'm not Nancy Grace, so. You know.
Yeah, and of course, we're always up against the old IOKIYAR. It's okay if you're a Republican problem.
Yeah.
Well, let's backtrack just a minute, Brad, and sort of put point A to point B and to point C and so forth. So we've got a guy who is alleged to have a profound and deep psychiatrically disturbed history, who somehow gets a job inside a super secure bioweapons lab in Maryland. We okay so far?
Sounds perfectly reasonable. Keep going.
Okay. This guy works there diligently, is apparently liked by his coworkers. His neighbors give the usual stock line of he was a great neighbor and we never had any trouble out of him and never would have expected this from him. You know, the sort of the shock and dismay response that the neighbors are always giving.
Right.
But somewhere along the way, this guy gets a hard-on for liberals.
Mm-hmm.
And he puts together letters that say things like, America will die, Allah is great, death to America. And they contain a dried-out form of anthrax, even though he never worked with a dry anthrax spore in the course and scope of his duties at Fort Detrick.
That's right. Let me add a few more other details of note here. Apparently, everyone at that Fort Detrick facility who actually aided in the investigation, the FBI's investigation, they were all reportedly given polygraph tests in 2002. So Ivins would have had to have taken that polygraph test and successfully passed that polygraph test in order to, you know, to continue working there, even despite the claims of this social worker. She wasn't a psychiatrist or a therapist. She was merely a social worker, and, you know, who said that he was attempting revenge killings as far back as 2000. Yet with all of that, having passed the polygraph test, he was still allowed to keep his top-secret clearance and continue working in that lab until just, I think, a couple of weeks ago when he finally went to a psychiatric facility.
This is curiouser and curiouser, said Alice. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So all of this comes together. You've even got anecdotal stories from a guy who worked with him, who talked about, and apparently this will become an issue somewhere down the road, the missing set of BDUs. Are you familiar with this, Brad?
Of BDUs?
Yes, battle dress uniform. Fatigues, in other words.
Ah, no, I'm not.
Okay, so Bruce Ivins borrowed a pair of BDUs from another gentleman, and the FBI was on him like a duck on a June bug. Are you missing a pair of BDUs? And the guy says, "Why, yes, I am. As a matter of fact, I loaned them to Bruce. He was going to a costume party dressed as a member of the Village People." And that becomes a central tenet of this, according to this interview on the Today Show, where he had to sign an agreement with the FBI saying that he wouldn't talk about the missing BDUs with Bruce, or he himself would be arrested for discussing details of the investigation. And so one day, Bruce just brings back the BDUs, and they all have a big laugh, and you know that's but nobody can discuss it. Because everything is super double secret probation with this whole investigation, so it's an amazing.
Well, you would have had, and you know, while I can understand, you know, keeping this the information of such an investigation under wraps, although it doesn't explain why they leaked so much out about Stephen Hatfield, which turned out to be completely baloney, and you know, cost the government $5.8 million in a settlement. But I can understand them keeping the details of such an investigation under wraps.
During the pendency of the investigation, I not only understand it, I expect it.
Well, that's right. What I can understand, though, is if this guy was the guy, if they were so worried about him, how do you explain that he was allowed to keep his top secret clearance for this facility? All of these years, how do you explain that he took a polygraph test back in 2002 and apparently passed it? And, you know, it brings us back to that circumstantial case. You know, and we should say, look, this guy might be the guy. We have not seen
right. This is not the Bruce Ivins apology fan club. No.
We haven't seen the case. But if the FBI doesn't have something, I mean, if these, anthrax letters were able to kill folks, you know, in Connecticut somehow or another because, you know, the material on them aerosolized and somehow leaked out of the letters, then I presume there's going to be traces of anthrax in this guy's car as he had to have driven from Maryland to New Jersey to mail the letter. So there's going to be hard, non-circumstantial evidence to show in the government's case, right? We'll see. It sure doesn't sound like it from the information that appears to be leaking out, and you'd think, with all the questions that have been brought up already, that someone in the government would have leaked out that, yes, we've got evidence somehow linking him hard to these anthrax spores. But I've heard nothing.
No, nor I. And then the final piece of the puzzle, and it's what we mentioned at the top of the conversation, Brad. I have this penchant, if you will, for viewing one's politics as playing a part in one's overall in one's overall makeup. We are very political people, and as such, I mean, for instance. You would be hard pressed to find me out flyering the county for the local Republican gubernatorial candidate, just as a for instance.
Say it ain't so, Bob.
Well, it ain't. it ain't now and ain't gonna. But the fact of the matter is that would be unlikely because it is contrary to everything that I think, feel, and believe. Right?
Yep.
And one of the ways that we manifest that is in our political we manifest our politics in our political affiliations.
Right.
So in the past, back when they caught the BTK killer out in Kansas, remember, bind, torture, and kill, the guy that terrorized, what was it, Topeka or wherever for years on end by just randomly strangling and killing and torturing women.
Yep.
When they caught him, I called out and checked with the Voter Registration Board to find out, you know, how he voted.
Right.
And lo and behold, he was a registered Republican, and he had voted in every Republican primary. He had voted in every general election. He was a Republican.
Right.
Okay, so a little bit later, this guy who is a Christian disc jockey in Nashville, Tennessee, gets popped with a computer full of kiddie porn. Well, same thing obtains, and I call voter registration there, and I find out that this guy is a Republican.
Right.
And I just, you know, just sort of, it's part of my little checklist. So I did the same thing today. I got in touch with the Board of Elections and the election supervisor in Frederick County, Maryland. And I asked them what their rules were. Was it public record? Yes, it is. So I sent them a letter. They said we need a signed letter. So I sent them a signed letter requesting information on the voter registration of Bruce Ivins.
Right.
And because of certain rules, they couldn't send, they could not fax or email me that information. So they said, you can either wait for the mail to run. And then I said, well, I'm under deadline. And they said, well, we'll tell you on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
So they called back. They spoke to Agnes, my lovely wife and partner in this enterprise.
Uh-huh.
And they informed her that Bruce Ivins, the man who allegedly mailed toxic, poisonous, homicidal, dry anthrax spore letters to liberals, had been a registered Democrat since 1982.
Yep.
And had voted in every election since 1996. And Maryland, and this is important, Maryland has, and you know what they are, most everybody else does too, Maryland has closed primaries.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like some states where you can be a registered Republican and vote on the Democratic primary, or, in other words, do all that Operation Chaos stuff that Rush Limbaugh was so fond of. If you're a Democrat in Maryland and you want to vote in the primary, you're by God voting in the Democratic primary.
Right.
If you're a registered Republican, you're voting in the Republican primary. So,
and they confirmed to you, in fact, that he had voted even in the primary elections?
Oh, yeah. He's voted in every election held in Frederick County since 1996.
Since 1996?
Yes.
Yeah. So that means he's voted in Democratic primaries?
Yes.
Now, that said, and I think that's a pretty huge piece of information, and it's incredible that no one in the media had thought to do that until now. In fact, as I was covering the questions about this guy's political affiliation, I, in fact, thought of doing exactly that on Friday, never got around to it. I'm glad you beat me to it. He had registered, what was it, 1982, I believe you said.
Yes, his registration went back to 92.
And people, you know, do change their political beliefs over time. There are some letters to the editor that he sent that seem to indicate that he was that Ivins was slanting to the right. It is possible that he could have changed his political beliefs but not changed his political affiliation. Changed his registration. You know, people, if they don't move, they don't tend to change their registration, and it could stay as is. And yet, you're right. He was voting in these Democratic primaries. Even that could be explainable. Oh, it's, you know, he didn't want to bother to change his registration. He didn't mind voting in the Democratic.
He had a buddy who was the sheriff, and he happened to be a Democrat, and he wanted to be able to vote for the sheriff in the primary. Sure.
Sure. And that could, so that's explainable. What's not explainable is the fact that nobody has done that up until now, and that the question has not even come up on the table other than largely at Brad Blog, where we've been focusing on this, and the fact that, you know, nobody seems to be looking at this political affiliation of this guy. That would seem, the piece of the puzzle that you, Bob Kincaid, have uncovered would seem to be a crucial piece of information, even if it's not necessarily demonstrative of any particular thing. It seems common sense.
Oh, it's not. No, it's not probative of innocence or guilt.
Right.
But it is. It's an overall picture of the puzzle. And you know, for me, because Maryland has the closed primary system, I'm a little bit more inclined to think that even though he wrote these letters to the editor that I haven't seen them. I've only seen them referred to.
Yeah.
Even so, at some point in time, if you go over the line, you do change, especially in a closed primary state.
You would think.
Because I mean, there's family values to vote on, and there's national security, and save the fetuses, and keep the gays from getting married. All those things that are so important to rightward leaning politics in this country.
You would certainly think, and yet he didn't, and certainly you would think, good Lord, someone who virulently believed enough in this administration to have made these phony attacks trying to point, you know, people towards a war against Muslim extremists, boy, you sure think he would change his affiliation at the very least, but he apparently didn't. And I find that remarkable. Had he been a Republican, and when you told me this earlier today via email, frankly, I was stunned because I would have, you know, bet dollars to donuts, even on the little that has been reported on Ivins, that it would have come back saying that he was a Republican.
Well, so, frankly, that's where I was going too. And on the other hand, I was expecting things to run true to form because the guy that the government settled with, Stephen Hatfield. Now, this guy was a sure enough bona fide right wing, you know, liberals are killing America type.
Right.
I mean, that much was verified.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy that wrote the article for, I believe, Vanity Fair,
mm-hmm.
you know, Hatfield went out and sued everybody who had mentioned his name.
Yeah.
But the guy who wrote the article for Vanity Fair said of Hatfield that his movements, the anthrax letters followed his movements like a cloud. Those were his words. So, you know, I would have expected that something would have manifested itself similarly, with Ivins.
Yeah.
And I can't help but go back to, you know, do you remember, we're used to this phrase now, Brad, person of interest.
Right.
Do you remember that person of interest was invented exclusively for Stephen Hatfield?
Was it invented for him or was it invented after the Richard Jewell business with the Olympics Park bomb?
It
actually might have been invented, or at least widely heard for the first time with Stephen Hatfield because they had identified Richard Jewell as a quote unquote suspect.
Right, and that's the word. That is the word. Person of interest. I remember the discussions at the time, Brad, of veteran law enforcement professionals, the FBI guys, state police guys, forensic guys, veteran prosecutors and so forth, opining here and there. I have never before heard this phrase in my life. I have no idea what a person of interest is. Because there's a very sort of Byzantine stylized language, especially in federal prosecutions, where in fact, if you're you have an entitlement to what is called a target letter from a federal prosecutor if you are the target of an investigation,
which I think is the sort of the next step up from person of interest.
Right, but they wouldn't issue a target letter on Stephen Hatfield, and so you know John Ashcroft came out, and frankly, he's it's the early phases of the investigation, Brad, that were completely botched. I mean, this is how not to run a murder investigation if you want to get right down to it. And it's further evidence, I think, and I think this case has tentacles that maybe a lot of us haven't contemplated. And that is, it points in so many different directions to the incompetence of this administration, to the malevolence of this administration, and I'm not even talking about if they did the deed, to the venality and the mendacity of this administration. Whether it's person of interest or whether it's Ashcroft running out to crow about this prematurely, they're not very competent. You know, and that's what you get out of a Justice Department whose philosophical goal has been to hire as many lawyers as possible out of the 247th best law school in the country.
I'll go one step further, certainly where you were headed, and I'll also note, by the way, Bob, that I'm going to cover this in an article, hopefully posted shortly here this evening after we get off the air, or after I get off the air, but, you know, maybe this is a good way to round up the hour. You say this is no way to run an investigation, murder investigation. I'll say this is no way to run an administration. This is no way to run a country. We have become an outlaw nation. As far as I'm concerned, all of the law enforcement agencies, all of the organizations who used to serve to protect us, to be the watchdogs, whether it's the DOJ, whether it's state's attorney general, whether it's Congress, whether it's the media, every single one of them have failed the American people. We have become an outlaw nation, as far as I'm concerned. It is so much worse than I think people understand it to be right now. But, you know, I think we're damn near at the point of organized anarchy, if I can use a phrase like that.
Oddly enough, as contradictory as the term sounds, it makes more sense than most of us would probably like to admit, and I know exactly what you're talking about. Brad, thank you for spending this last hour with us. I think this was an important discussion, and I think it was a valuable, viable discussion as well. And I can't wait to see what comes up next as you follow up on this, and we'll make sure that folks follow what you bring out.
Well, thank you for taking the initiative, for doing what the corporate mainstream media has failed to do. You know, these simple steps, and citizens like yourself, doing the right thing and doing what the media used to do, have been extraordinarily vulnerable, valuable in this outlaw nation, in trying at least to restore some kind of law and order to this country.
And what I will do, Brad, one last thing, when I do get off the air, it's on my mail client on the other computer, but I will forward you the email that I did send to the Frederick County Board of Elections so that you can see the request and how it was phrased and have that, at least that half of the documentary portion of it.
Thank you, sir, and please free to forward me, or I can probably go out and find it at Head On Radio, the MP3 to this discussion, as I will certainly include it in my article.
I'll cut it out and provide it to you forthwith, as soon as the show's over.
Thank you, brother. Great talking to you, and thanks again for taking some action here in this mess.
Well, Brad, it's always a pleasure, and let's not be such strangers.
You know my number. Always happy to talk to you, Bob.
All right. Take care, Brad.
Thank you, my friend.
Bye now.
Bye.
Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com. It was Brad who lit the fire under me to, you know, call and find out that, and you know, little things matter. But if you followed, for instance, the story of the Knoxville killer, you know that there is a that the right wingers. That's not fair to talk about the fact that he was a Hannity listener and that he was taking marching orders from Michael. That's not fair. Well, baby, this is an investigation. We're not talking about what's fair and what's not. We're talking about what's facts and what ain't. And it's a fact. And for somebody who was running around trying to kill liberals, I mean, we don't know if this guy was guilty or not. We probably will never know now. But for somebody who was running around trying to kill liberals, seeing that he was not just a casually registered Democrat, but that he was a long-term registered Democrat, that's a little bothersome. Not to say that Democrats don't kill or can't go around the bend. But it certainly is another big old question mark in the heart and soul of this case. At least the way that I see it. So we'll take a break here at the top of the hour and come back with the final hour of this Monday night edition of Head On. Jump right in if you've got something you want to say. You know the number. 304-658-3333. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn.
tonight's final hour of Head On begins next. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
We will move on in just a minute, especially to your phone calls, if that's what you want to do. A little bit of here and there, just sort of picking up some loose ends. Cossack writes in and reminds us, Bob, just for what it's worth, this quote from Richard Cohen, who was mentioned by Brad Friedman in our discussion. This quote, he wrote, "The attacks were not entirely unexpected. I had been told soon after September 11th to secure Cipro, the antidote to anthrax. The tip had come in a roundabout way from a high government official, and I immediately acted on it. I was carrying Cipro way before most people had ever heard of it." From an article, and then an article, "How Did I Get Iraq Wrong?" First line, "I thought we had a chance to stabilize an unstable region, and I admit it, I wanted to strike back." Whew. At who? I mean, Jesus, the anthrax story, in a way, is like reopening a wound that isn't healing very well. Because it takes us back to those days immediately after September the 11th, 2001, when the Bush administration was anxiously ginning up an absolutely illegal, immoral, criminal, fraudulent war of choice against a people who had done us no wrong. Now, granted, as Bush was wont to tell people, of Saddam, "He tried to kill my daddy." Yeah, maybe he did. He did so very ineptly and very ineffectually. I mean, if there was ever a Wile E. Coyote super genius cartoon character evil dictator on this planet, Saddam Hussein was him. He killed heavy-handedly and ham-fistedly. And he ruled to a certain extent with an iron fist. And yet people were free to practice their religions in Iraq. There was a Christian community there that no longer exists. Women did not have to put on a beekeeper suit to walk down the street, didn't have to be accompanied by 19 dozen male relatives in order to be seen in public. And that's all gone now. It's all gone. It's all gone, just like the billions and billions and billions of dollars of your money. Remember George Bush? That's what he told you in 2000 when he was running for president. He wanted to make sure you understood. It's your money. And he spent billions, if not trillions, of your dollars waging war against a people who had done us no harm. And going back into this anthrax story just rips the scab off, and you know how bad that hurts. And now there it is, suppurating, weeping, and oozing all over again. And we do have to time travel. Because no matter how badly it hurts, it is worth it to get it right. To actually find the answers. Why was Dick Cheney on Cipro? Why was Richard Cohen on Cipro? How do you get a prescription for Cipro when you're not sick in the first place? Unless you're Flush Flemball and you're going for a Dominican Republic boys' weekend and you get a script for Viagra under your doctor's name because you don't want anybody finding out that, you know, you need it or want it. You know, that little money grubber, I'm surprised he actually went that route when he could have had a big endorsement deal with Pfizer. I mean, Lord knows, the morals are... Nothing else has ever slowed him down. But we do reopen it. And there are some facts out there. At the time of the anthrax attack, another guy was on Cipro. And that is this man with whom the federal government has recently settled back in June. $5.8 million to settle a case because of the screw-ups, the monstrous screw-ups, all the way from the top down of the United States Department of Justice, beginning with Attorney General John maybe he didn't need the Cipro. He was just going to heal it by pouring Crisco on his own head. Weirdo. But anyway, others were on Cipro as well. Stephen Hatfill was on Cipro. He claimed that he had been taking Cipro because he had had a lingering sinus infection. He also said he was taking the Cipro because he had had surgery back before the anthrax attacks. Sinus surgery. Okay. He sued the New York Times for not printing that business about him taking it for his sinuses. He sued the New York Times for that, and that lawsuit was thrown out by a federal judge on a summary judgment. It wasn't even tried. Hatfill was also involved with a man named Joseph Soukup, S-O-U-K-U-P. Who was his collaborator at a company called Science Applications International Corporation, and there was a running gag about it that said its initials, what are its initials spelled backward? CIA's. Had a bunch of contracts with the CIA. And they, Hatfill and SAIC Vice President Joseph Soukup, engaged William C. Patrick, a retired head of the old U.S. bioweapons program. He'd also been Hatfill's mentor, to generate a report about the possibilities of a terrorist anthrax mailing attack. Fascinating stuff. One individual claimed that the report was commissioned under a CIA contract to SAIC, but SAIC then said Hatfill and Soukup commissioned the study internally, that there was no outside client. No, outside client, no. So the report is generated and dated February of 1999. And it is later viewed by the FBI as an absolute blueprint for the anthrax attacks of 2001, the ones we're talking about. The report determined, among other things, that the maximum amount of anthrax powder that could be put in an envelope without creating a bulge, a suspicious bulge, was 2.5 grams. The anthrax in the letter that was sent to liberal Senator Tom Daschle was 2 grams. The same thing about this is that criminal investigations are of a nature such that if you screw them up, it's very difficult to go back and unscrew them. I maintain no illusions about the anthrax attacks. It is necessary that we try to find the answers, but we may not. It may not happen. We may not be able to discern or discover those answers, because any hope of finding them may have been destroyed by the inept Keystone Cops approach of the single most inept presidential administration in the history of the United States. Evidence gets contaminated, evidence gets lost, leads aren't followed, people die, people forget things, human memory is not perfect. And the next thing you know, the 2001 anthrax attacks are just another one of those question marks. Why did it happen? How did it happen? Why were administration officials on Cipro with no verifiable illness? Why were journalists who were given a heads up on Cipro with no verifiable illness? Why did the journalists themselves not turn around and at least generate some sort of a report instead of quietly carrying that bottle of Cipro around? You know, people died in those terrorist attacks. And again, I reiterate to you, please remember, every time you hear some right-wing moron say, well, we ain't been attacked since 9/11, and therefore George W. Bush is our great leader who is protecting the nation as our maximum commander-in-chief. Every time you hear that, please think anthrax. Ask one of them once in a while, what about the anthrax attacks, dumbass? Where do those fit in your little world where we ain't been attacked? Because that was after September 11th, and there's just no getting around it. Even if you are a faith-based repig-lick and operating on nothing but the Tinkerbell side of your tiny little brain. Just beats the dickens out of me. Makes me crazy. But all of that is out there. And it is not being addressed. It is not being questioned. It is not being queried. It is not being touched by the for-profit media. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine that you are a hotshot reporter for the for-profit media, and you're making six figures a year, and you don't even have the common sense to pick up the phone and call the Board of Elections and find out if this mass murderer of liberals was a conservative or a repig-licking? Whether it's the final piece in the puzzle or a piece in the puzzle or not a piece in the puzzle, you gather all the facts you can to put together the entire picture. But it doesn't even occur to these geniuses. Just astonishes me. It simply astonishes me. You know, hard to know what to make of it. Either you're deliberately avoiding information, or you just don't have the common sense that God gave a doorknob. All facts are relevant until proven otherwise. People have killed for less than political affiliations. People, what one judge I once knew in Alabama referred to as nice domestic homicides, he used to talk about those people killing over something as trivial as what was for dinner that night. People have killed for less, and yet it's immediately deemed irrelevant because, you know, we can't talk about that. If you don't examine all possible motives, how in the hell can you possibly know what the motives are? But I remember the right-wing hissy back when I found out that the BTK killer was a registered Republican. You didn't find that out. They didn't tell you. Yeah, they did. Yeah, they did. Yeah, they did. So, Lori, I'm sure we can look forward to more brilliant journalism from the for-profit media. Inspiring, isn't it? Just terribly, terribly inspiring. Now, what's on tap for the rest of the evening? Your calls if you want to chime in. We'll take a quick break just to have a little musical interlude. We'll come back. We will see where the rest of the evening takes us. And it's about 21 minutes past the hour, 21 minutes past the final hour of this evening's program. You're listening to America's Liberal Voice. You're listening to The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. Okay, we're back. Listen, gang, full disclosure here. I had a tough day Saturday feeling like something like a kidney stone or a kidney infection or a kidney something or other. And any of you who have ever had kidney pain, know that it's a special brand of hell. And in the last few minutes, it has kicked up again. And I'm telling you, I'm a trooper and everything, but I can't make it the next 34 minutes of the program. I've got to go lay down or do something. Because it hurts real, real bad. So I apologize. Peter Godbold is a rerun this evening. And that will start promptly at 9. And after that, everything else is a rerun as well until Guy James comes your way, live as live can be, along about 3 o'clock Eastern time tomorrow. Many thanks to Brad Friedman for spending an hour with us this evening. Whatever it is that's happened to me just kicked up in the last 15 minutes, and, man, it hurts. So I'm going to disappear for a while, and thank you very much to everybody in every sort of way, for the same reasons that I began the program this evening. Thank you to everyone. Thank you to Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, the bravest, hardest-working people that I know. Thank you to John. Thank you to Peter. Thank you to Ben, ELO, News Ninja Susan, News Ninja Gene, Texas Betsy the Blogger, everyone who is associated with this endeavor, and especially you, and always, 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 RNR, Gina, it's all for you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.